An Evening with the Sladdens, 1915. Part 3.
The Battle of Loos, the largest British battle to take place in 1915, was fought on the Western Front from 25th to 28th September.
George wrote his mother on the 3rd of October.
My dear mother, we've had stirring times since I wrote last, for we were where the trouble was thickest, and though resting now, I hope that things will continue to hum, and that when we get going into the front line again, it will be to press forward. It's a great change to get the chance of seeing German prisoners, and the most pleasing thing I have seen out here, I think, was a battery of field guns that we had captured being taken to the rear. Another new experience we had recently was an introduction to the real article in heavy German shells, though luckily at a safe distance. They were fired by a gun which was probably one of the famous 17-inch howitzers, though rumour, which loves exaggeration, say that they were 21-inch monsters. They burst about half a mile away at leisurely intervals. The first few did no harm, but at last we saw a great burst which raised not the usual cloud of grey-black smoke, but a yellowish-reddish cloud of enormous dimensions. When it cleared, we could see that a block of houses, I heard afterwards that there were three of them, had disappeared. They were flattened right out. I must roll call. Love to all, from George.
Arthur, meanwhile, had moved to a different hospital, as he told his mother.
My dear mother, I moved a short distance last Monday to Meerut British General Hospital, just south of No. 9 General, on the edge of the forest. I have been appointed bacteriologist there, so shall have a busy time, as this is the isolation and observation hospital for all infectious diseases. The great part of this work is the investigation of typhoid or suspected typhoid cases. All such cases come from the base and the lines of communication are sent here. There are four other officers here. We live in tents, not quite so comfortable as the huts of our number nine. Our tents are in an apple orchard, rather a pretty spot. I got father's letter this morning with news of Cyril and George. Rouen has been frightfully busy since the big fighting began, and every hospital is expanded, but understaffed. It is too sooner to know the net result of the fighting. There are some indications today that things are quieter. I hope all goes well. I think George's regiment must be near a village which we captured in the first day or two of the battle. Mary seems well, and baby is doing well, I gather, and begins to take notice of people. I hope you will get news of George often. Of course, the postal service up the line just now is likely to be delayed. With much love to all, from your son, Arthur.
By mid-October, Cyril found himself back on Lemnos.
My dear mother, I have been put in the base camp at West Point. Nobody can say how long I shall be kept here. I know there cannot be any serious shortage up at the front at present, as a fair number of new officers have just gone up. Also, I am told that preference is given to officers here who have not yet seen any fighting. If this is correct, my turn is likely to be some time ahead. It is a strange sort of existence here, doing the old familiar training work just by way of keeping the men's hands in properly and keeping them fit. But with men who have, many or most of them, recently been in the real thing, it seems rather odd playing the sham game. The most unsatisfactory part of this place is the hopeless lack of news. We simply cannot get a single English paper, old or new. We live chiefly on rumours of official telegrams, about two-thirds of which turn out incorrect subsequently. When this is added to the difficulty in securing letters, it makes one feel rather isolated. Best love to all from your affectionate son, Cyril E. Sladden.
Meanwhile, in London, there had been a Zeppelin raid on the night of the 14th of October. Juliet sent an excited postcard to her parents.
We had a zap over last night, but no harm done here. I didn't see it, but of course we heard the bombs. And the gun went off, and there was quite an excitement. We assembled in the comm room at 9:45, but it was all over in about 10 minutes. By the time we got there, Miss Lacey said there was no danger, as it was going right away from us. But she wouldn't let us go near the windows to see if we could see anything. She and Miss Fletcher went up onto the roof, and when they had made sure it was quite gone, they sent us all back to bed again. They came again at 11:15 and 12, but not near us. I heard the bombs dropping. What annoyed me, though, was this. Next morning, I discovered that Joyce and Sylvia had been up on the roof with Miss Lacey and the others, watching the bombs dropping over Woolwich and Croydon. I do so wish I had gone up there too. Love from Juliet.
At the end of October, Kathleen wrote to her mother from Brighton.
My dear mother, as Jack found that it would be possible for him to get Monday off, we decided we would get away from the Zepps for 2 nights and come down here from Saturday to Monday in the hopes of getting a little sun and sea air. I'm getting very anxious for further news of Cyril. We know nothing later than that he left Alexandria on October the 2nd, and as we have had no word from home, I suppose you have heard nothing either, or Mila, who would have let you know. I had a letter from George last Tuesday, dated, I think, the 22nd. I think that may be later than your last. He said they were all in very good spirits, as hopeful as they had ever been. He asked me to send him a shirt and some candles, which I sent off yesterday morning, together with chocolate, potted meats, biscuits, tin milk, and cocoa. He says he washes his own shirts when opportunity offers, as those sent back as clean from the military laundry are apt to have undesirable tenants. If Jack had not been able to get off this weekend, I meant to propose coming down for a night or two to see you and make my little niece's acquaintance, which I should have loved to do. But as Jack has been looking rather London-y lately, it seemed a pity not to get a little break and change. Jack went to Dr. Grace's funeral on Tuesday. It was at Elmer's End Cemetery near Beckenham. There were a great number of people there, among them Ranjit Singhji. Much love to you all. Your affectionate daughter, Kathleen.
The funeral which Jack attended was that of W.G. Grace, the famous cricketer. Ranjit Singhji was a noted Test cricketer who played for the English cricket team. Meanwhile, George wrote excitedly to his mother on the 11th of November to say that he was about to come home on leave.
My dear mother, this is not going to be a very long letter. Firstly, because I have very little to tell you, and secondly, because I hope to be able to parade to you for inspection before very long. It may be a matter of days, or it might be so much as a fortnight. The gist of the matter is that I have been promised my leave shortly. An elastic term, but nevertheless not capable of indefinite expansion. Anyway, I feel that the leave is practically under my hand, waiting to be taken, and you can imagine that I feel just about as joyful as can possibly be at the prospect. Even the cattle truck that conveys me coastwards will have all the glamour of a Cinderella's coach. Welcome the stormiest of seas and the most uncomfortable of passages, so that I get a week to peep at you all at home. I shall try and let you have a telegram to warn you of my coming. In addition to everything else, the weather is beastly at present, and the mud stupendous. Fancy escaping to the cleanliness of civilization for a while. Till then, love from your affectionate son, George.
Cyril had at last reached the front line by the 21st of November.
My dear mother, I am really back at work again at last. I embarked a week ago today, but rough weather delayed our landing until Tuesday morning, and I ultimately reached here that night. It was very nice seeing all faces again, unfortunately not many of them, but sufficient to make it still the old regiment. I find it quite difficult to accustom myself to the conditions here. By comparison with my later experiences, I had come to regard my first trial of trench warfare as a very quiet and peaceful affair, so much so that it scarcely seemed worthy of much reference. But compared with this, it was most strenuous. I really believe you could jump over the parapet and walk about in broad daylight for a quarter of a minute and stand an excellent chance of never being noticed, let alone hit. I don't propose to try it, though. I think the wily Turk, having put up plenty of wire, is probably turning all his attention to making himself thoroughly comfortable for the winter. We cannot see much of him, as the crest of a slight hill lies between our front lines of trench, which are roughly 200 yards apart, I should say. Occasionally, we get a few shells from our left flank, but there is little more to worry about. I have been given a company for the time being, so I was very glad to arrive while they were in reserve. Last night, we took over the firing line trenches again. I had time, meanwhile, to find out a bit about things and pick up the threads. The rations issued here are very good indeed, the best I have experienced out of England. Considering the difficulties involved in supply, I think they are excellent. Love to all from your affectionate son, Cyril Eastlatton.
A rare letter from Ethel, who had just celebrated her 33rd birthday. As you may recall, Ethel was not a great letter writer, but at the end of November was visiting friends in London and wrote to her mother.
My dear mother, it was very good of you to write to me for my birthday, as you had written so recently before then. Many thanks for your letter and good wishes. Expect me home on Tuesday. I hope to meet Kathleen on Tuesday and lunch with her before going down. I was glad to get a further glimpse of George yesterday, but I'm afraid it was the last I see of him this time. Everyone thinks George is looking so well. He's broadened out a great deal. I was sorry not to be at home when he was there, as I should have seen much more of him. I'm glad Mila has had news of Cyril recently, and that he had received some letters. I wonder what they'll do down there this winter. I shall enjoy seeing something of Judy on Sunday. I expect she will come over in the morning. I shall be glad to see you all again on Tuesday. I'm afraid you've had too much to do, especially as you've had a cold. With much love to all, I remain your affectionate daughter, Ethel N. Sladden.
George did come home on leave, as he hoped, spent a few days in Badsey, and then returned to London. Just at the end of his leave on the 26th of November, he wrote his mother with some astonishing news.
My dear little mother, if I can keep myself from trying to write with the butt end of my pen, or can find sufficient control of my brains for a few minutes, I will tell you my great piece of news. I am engaged. Voila! It only happened this evening, rather late on, and I've just rushed home, knocked up Kath, told her I made a ridiculous job of the telling, I was so excited, and now set out to let everybody know, starting, of course, with you. My sweetheart is Rose Lintott, a niece of my friend of that name. I met her first at Watford and have kept up a heavy correspondence during the time I have been abroad. Forgive me now for having been rather neglectful of you several times. It was a case of love at first sight with me, and as far as I can make out, Rosie didn't take much longer than I did. But then she is younger than I am, and consequently a bit more cautious. She is just a month and a bit older than Betty, if you measure by the calendar, but real age is about 22, though she is liable to occasional relapses to 18. How can I describe her to you? Ordinary descriptive methods might make her just seem an ordinary person, whereas she's rosy. Well, anyway, she's about Betty's size, and her eyes are blue, and her hair is golden brown, and... Oh, bother, these are hard facts. They don't give you a bit of an idea of her. I give it up. She works for her living as a telephone operator. A beast of a job, I think. No, she's not got a telephone voice. She lives at Edgware with her mother, who has married again after being left a widow, and has been more than unlucky in her second choice. He's a regular bad one. I want to hear from her first, and then I will ask you to write to her. You can and will, I know, write to my little girl at once. I'm awfully happy, even though I've got to go away at once. Write and make me happier by your good wishes. Of course, I know I ought to have waited till après la guerre, but I couldn't. How could I help it? Goodbye. Love from George.
Well, we didn't see that one coming, did we? What a dark horse. The next day he wrote to Juliet.
My dearest Bet, little did you guess when I told you to op it that 5 minutes afterwards I was going to meet my future wife in the same station. Sensation in court. In fact, she wasn't that then. We plighted our troth between 10 and 11 p.m. tonight, partly in a taxi and partly on a secluded pavement beside Baker Street Station. Thank heaven for anti-Zeppelin precautions. Rosie is only a month and a half older than you. Think of that. What shall I say besides? There is so much that it seems impossible to say anything. Pretty, you ask? Of course she is. What a question. Shy with strangers, not bookish, fond of town amusements, in fact a bit frivolous. Often a terrible tease to me, bless her. Very direct and honest. Can be silent without being dull, and doesn't want to be forever talking without a reason. These are just a few odd glimpses to try and give you a rough idea of her. Kath is to meet her tomorrow. Perhaps you may see her sometime before very long, but I want the home people to wait until I can take Rosie down there myself. Love from George. P.S. I want the very nicest kind of letter from you.
The reaction from the family was mixed. Kathleen, Jack, Juliet and Arthur all wrote with their reactions.
My dear mother, you will get George's letter tomorrow morning, I hope, and I will write at once this evening, as you will want to hear my impressions of his little girl. He's told you, I know, that she's only 18. But though she is so young, I should think she is a sensible little person. She's not very big, hardly as tall as I am, certainly not so large, and is rather pretty, with a natural, gentle manner, which is quite winning. George and she lunched together, and I met them by arrangement before he had to go off, to say goodbye, and carry her off for a little walk and chat and tea together. One could see that they are very much in love with each other, and it was hard to have to part so soon. But she was very plucky over it. By the way, I doubt if George was sensible enough last night to give you her address. 8 Whitchurch Lane, Edgware. Perhaps he told you that her father is dead and her mother has married again. Not a very successful affair. Her name is now Mrs. Wilkinson. I suppose he did succeed in giving you correctly her own name, Rosie Lintott. Rosina in full. Much love from Kathleen.
My dear mother, I will write this evening to wish you many happy returns of the third. I expect you were very surprised to hear of George's engagement. Both Kath and I were. When he told me he was engaged, I thought for a moment he must have met some fair damsel in France, until he said who she was. Kathleen will have given you her impressions of the lady. With love to all, I remain your affectionate son, John D. Sladden.
My darling mother, well, isn't George's engagement quite the most thrilling event which has happened in the family for ages? I was very surprised at it coming, just that particular time. But I was fully expecting that he would get engaged before long. He wrote me such a nice letter to inform me of it. I am most anxious to see Rosie. It would be so nice for me if we take to each other to have somebody practically my age in the family. With much love and best wishes for your birthday, your affectionate daughter, Juliet E. Sladden.
My dear Kathleen, I feel between ourselves that the family as a whole extends rather a qualified approval of George's engagement. But, after all, a fellow working in the government office and then serving in the ranks is not especially likely to make a match regarded as brilliant from the world's point of view. As long as she has character and intellect, I expect it'll turn out quite well. Less difference in age, especially for George, would be an advantage. I hope she has a will of her own. One thing, very petty, doesn't please me, that the name's Rosie. I can't help picturing a pink and white, helpless Dickens female. But I know the name is misleading, and I don't take that fancy seriously. With love, your affectionate brother, Arthur.
Apologies to anybody in the audience who's called Rosie. So they weren't also excited about the engagement, but George was delighted to receive Juliet's approval.
My dear Betty, first come, first served. As you beat everybody else except Mother in writing to congratulate me, so you shall have your letter answered first. It really was a very delicious one. Apart from the natural predilection for that age of 18 that I now have, I found more satisfaction in the nice things you said than in any from the older letter writers who implied, "She's very young, my boy, she's very young." That you understand was the theme, treated in various ways, rather in sonato form, some allegro, some rondo, some adagio, some almost andante. You were for some days the only one who understood. Later on, Arthur and Mary and Mila brought me more satisfaction, especially Arthur. You note that all of these have travelled the delectable country. That makes a very great difference. Yes, young woman, I expect Mother is feeling quivers of apprehension about you after this awful example. I warn you, don't let it awaken you any unduly precocious sentiments. Remember, neither of us went for to do it. It just happened. So note it be at all times and with all people. It was perfectly beastly having to come out here again. How I hate it. Write again soon and tell me the home views. Your affectionate brother, George.
Meanwhile, far away in the Ottoman Empire, Cyril was having a torrid time, as he explained in a letter on the 5th of December to Mila.
My dear Mila, perhaps before I tell you of our late tribulations, I had better reassure you by saying at once that I personally am none the worse. But we certainly did have a perfectly awful time for a few days. On the evening of the 26th, we had such a downpour as I've never before seen, nor anything to approach it. It is my estimate that something like 3 or 4 inches at least must have fallen well inside 2 hours. Practically every trench and dugout was flooded, anything up to 3 or 4 feet deep. By the greatest luck, my dugout kept out almost all the rain and did not get flooded, so I kept myself and my kit dry, but I was one of very few indeed. The only thing to do was to keep the men working all night at draining and repairing the trenches. Next day was fine at first, and we seemed to be getting on all right, but it turned to drizzle and at night to sleet, and morning found about an inch of snow on the ground and a very cutting northeast wind blowing. Imagine the effect of such weather on men soaked, with no change and practically no shelter. The driest trenches were still some inches deep in liquid mud. On Sunday night it froze hard, which was, I think, a good thing, as long as it was going to be cold at all. Of course we made fires and did all possible to get dry and warm, and gave out frequent rum issues. The frost broke slowly so that we could tackle the mud as it thawed. As a regiment, I know we were lucky, being on a gentle rising hill, so that the water did not collect as it did in some of the lower ground. I wonder whether you will have some patients soon who will describe our last weekend to you. Very likely you may. God bless you, dearest. Your own most affectionate, Cyril E. Sladden.
The heavy rainstorm which struck on 26 November highlighted the untenable nature of the Allied position in the Dardanelles. In early December, a decision was taken to evacuate the peninsula. The evacuation itself was the best executed part of the entire Allied campaign.
Cyril was among the last of the troops to leave and sent a postcard to Mila on the 20th of December.
Dearest, last night I took part in a most interesting proceeding which I forbear to describe, though I have little doubts the papers will have plenty to say about it in a day or two. As a result, this morning finds me in a place I have not previously been in, enjoying the chance of stretching my legs and walking without turning a corner every 5 yards. I don't expect to be here long and anticipate a move to an old familiar spot for a time, probably to spend Christmas there. Subsequent proceedings are wrapped in the usual fog of war. It may be a return to the scene of war I went to when I originally came out. If the papers do enlighten you, you will understand pretty well why you have lately had so few letters, but I think I can pretty safely promise a great improvement in that in the future. I am hoping we shall get a real good fat Christmas mail in a few days' time. No letters have been forthcoming lately, but I didn't expect any under the circumstances. As this is not a letter, but only a message to report progress, I refrain from mentioning a cheery bit of news I have for your next letter. Please pass my news on to all at home. Very best love from your own Cyril.
The year was drawing to a close. George, who had returned to France, wrote a few days before Christmas about how he expected to spend the festive season with a glut of Christmas puddings.
My dear mother, I've just received your parcel of apples and Christmas pudding. Between the five of us, we look like faring sumptuously every day, for the number of parcels we are getting is formidable. I have had 3 in 3 days, and the others have also had a good many recently. We have eaten 3 puddings already, in order to clear the way for puddings already arrived or yet to come. Well, I shall think of you all on Christmas Day. I'm glad you are to be a good-sized party. I shall drink your healths in something or other. Rum and tea, as likely as not. Here's to a real Christmas and a happy new year for all of us. Love from George.
Cyril, after all his trials of the last few weeks, was able to spend Christmas Day on the island of Lemnos and wrote to Mila. He at last finds out about George's surprising news.
My own darling, I am spending today, as I had rather expected, in the same old place I left only about 6 weeks ago. It's a funny sort of Christmas. We had a short church parade service in the open. A certain amount of special Christmas gifts for the men are available. Yesterday, I spent £50 for the company on various things which I obtained from a very good canteen run by some chaplains. I was able to secure quite a good lot of stuff, which is being issued this afternoon. Cakes, oranges, chocolate, tinned salmon and sardines, etc. We had a mail last night. My share of the post was 3 letters, from you, father and mother. Yours was the long one, giving news of George's engagement. Certainly, it was a big surprise to me. For one thing, one never dreamt that any opportunity had been possible for forming an attachment during the war. Without seeing the lady, it is futile, really, to hold any opinion on the subject or the wisdom of the whole thing. Absurdly, I cannot yet swallow the name Rose, to which I have a strong antipathy. And the modification Rosie that Mother uses is just a stage worse. However, this is nothing against the poor girl, and I shall have time to get accustomed to it before reaching home. I told you in my note that I had a bit of news for you. My name has been sent in for promotion now that I have completed 30 days in command of a company. I am entitled to captain's pay from November the 17th. And now, and this is the point of the whole thing, supposing the promotion is fixed up all right, as I may reasonably expect, will you take the first chance that my return home may afford us to get married and face such risks and difficulties as may come? This is assuming I return in fit condition, of course. I expect you have been busy today, but I hope it has been a happy Christmas all the same. I am sure your patients have had the happier one for being looked after by you. All my love, dear, from your ever affectionate, Cyril E. Sladden.
Arthur wrote home on Boxing Day.
My dear mother, you would like to have an account of Christmas here, but first I must thank you very much for the photograph of you and little baby. I think it is simply a splendid one, and I can't look at it enough. All the photos of baby and Mary are exceedingly nice. I can hardly decide which is the best one. They show baby in different aspects, all charming. She looks so alert and bright. If a little solemn, that's because she's evidently felt it was a great occasion. The parcel came yesterday morning after a long delay, the best Christmas box I could possibly have out here. All wards were decorated with ivy and coloured paper. At St. Meerut, the men had a football match before dinner and then settled down to a good meal of orthodox turkey and plum pudding. We went round to drink their healths, and then on to the sergeant's mess. More health drinking. Later, there were various ward teas. In the mumps compound, we found the Bedlam Band. 6 months convalescents, who with 2 tin whistles, 2 tambourines and a mouth organ, made music of sorts during tea. In the evening, the men had a concert, and we entertained the sisters to dinner, giving it in their quarters, as ours are too small. All went quite well, though we were only 5 men to 30 women. I think the keynote of Christmas out here has been rather to forget the war and all that it means for a moment for those who can. I'm glad to think that 1915 is nearly out, and hope and believe that the end of 1916 will at least see the favourable end of war in sight, even if not achieved. With much love to all, dear mother, and good wishes for the next year, from your son, Arthur.
And so, 1915 drew to a close, with still no sign of an end to the war.
An Evening with the Sladdens, 1915, Part 3. The cast was Julius, Anthony Miller, Eugenie, Patsy Miller, Jack, Tony Spinks, May and Ethel, Jane Neal, Kathleen, Sandra Sparrow, Arthur, Chris Smith, George, Robin Neal, Cyril, Terry Sparrow, Juliet, Martha Murray, Mila, Bella Richards. The narrator was Will Dallimore, and the official voice Valerie McGann. The director was Maureen Spinks. An Evening with the Sladdens was a Badsy Society production.